Now, first of all, let me tell you that I have known Elena's work for decades and I agree to her arguments. So you won't see us argue or quarrel up here on stage. This is a talk among friends, a conversation of scholars who understand each other, but it might be useful to come back to your presentation, dear Elena, and focus on some of the details. Now, my first question goes back to the 19th century. You describe the historical development, the history. You describe the institutions and the evolution of the institutions, which are also typical for the Western world. And there were concepts which referred to antiquity and the Middle Ages. And you also mentioned the spirit of the time. And you speak about usurious money lending and theft. And then you say that money changes its character. And then you describe today. Now, this is a rather long period. And you say this is about monetarization, but then if we look back at the 19th century, we understand that people started to accept that you could go and sell labor, for example, whereas the monetarization of our present time is to be seen with respect to the values and the future. Now, what is the most important aspect for you here? Now, I gave you a very general description, and I think it's important to bear in mind that money is not about the material value or worth of products only, which implies complex conceptual steps. So people needed to get used to the idea of selling land. And then they got used to the idea of selling labor. Eventually, it was also possible to buy or sell friendship and others. So we have to see the concepts that matter here. The credit, I mean, there were credits already before, but they got increasingly important in the 19th century. And of course, the loan, the credits changed the meaning of things. Financial markets are no longer about concrete projects, i.e., normally I raise a credit, for example, in order to buy a house or so. But then, I mean, the mortgage might fail or not, but this is a concrete project. Now, if you consider the financial markets, just think of derivatives, for example, you realize that this is about a very different way of establishing a relationship between the money and the project. Well, that's true. Nevertheless, let me ask you about other authors. I mean, you mentioned Châtelier, you mentioned Keynes. And I would not agree. Châtelier is not a follower of Keynes. I think he's one of the few economists who takes insecurity and uncertainty serious. And he's also one of the forgotten economists who have now been rediscovered. And then you consider the concept of the risk society, which makes you think of Ulrich Beck in Germany. But the question is, who would be authors who do you refer to? I mean, who are the ones who give signals? Now, I'm a sociologist, and thus I'm focusing on social theory. And that's the background against which I consider systems and the theory of systems. But then, of course, there's always the danger of dilettantism. But I have to admit that I read many authors and I was very interested in their arguments. And they play an important role also as critics within the economy or economics. I mean, people tend to say we don't need the sociologists. But when it comes to uncertainty and social concepts, you have to admit that the concept of uncertainty is in sociology different from what economists would consider uncertainty, and in particular, if you consider Beck or Luhmann, for example. But then, what is the risk you're talking about? I mean, this is about building the future, right? So are we dealing with a society that builds or performs this future? Well, I don't see a difference here. Because if you don't know the future, and if the future depends on what we do today, each differentiation is risky or implies a risk. Because I might go and think today that things or projects might fail tomorrow. I mean, normally, I hope they won't fail, but I know they can fail. I anticipate. Right, but that's not a new idea. I mean, this also goes for traders who sent their ships to Indonesia. But today it's different because I know that I influence the future. Right. But the new thing is, how do I prepare? There are people who are involved. People who agree to take the risk, who are eager to take the risk. But of course, everything could be different, and of course, you can always do things differently. I mean, Bologna, we've just had an earthquake. But of course, we can't know for sure whether our house will collapse. But then, of course, we might have gone and built the houses in a more stable way. We might have done all this. There is a risk which cannot be avoided. Right. But then, let's furthermore focus on the concept of neutrality. Now, this is not about the freedom from risk, but it's about neutrality. But still, it seems to be mysterious. I mean, is it about symmetric risk? I.e., one risk that corresponds to another, and if something fails, I can do something different? And if so, where is the flaw? Where is the mistake? Why is the risk not a symmetrical one? Or is the dimension a different one? I mean, what do we overlook? Well, I consider the scientific literature from the outside, and often the asymmetric risk is being forgotten. There are extremely optimistic scientists or scholars, and people tend to forget that there, where someone wins, somebody else loses. I mean, that's what we also saw in the play last night. The enthusiasm about formality and mathematics. Now, we do have lots of problems, people tend to think, because we don't calculate well. So we can, and that's the implication, organize things so that everybody wins. So we plan, we calculate, and we do it better. But that's not true. I mean, just imagine everything is part of a perfect setting, the setting as such is perfect, but then the concepts you use imply a risk, because certain scenarios of the future are being developed, but the fact that you work with models as such implies more complexity and the whole might fail. Now, is it then performativity you talk about? Well, yeah. This has become a rather fashionable term. But if you consider the linguistic side, you might think of Austin, for example. Who speaks about words and the concrete implication of words, like I go and declare you husband and wife. There, a performance is involved. So sociologists in this context always think of concrete objects, and these are, so to speak, the models economists and scholars in general use. But then, what about the hedge fund players and others? I mean, they are smart, aren't they? And they have recognized the dimension, and they consider the implication in their calculations. I read a study recently and this was about the data transmitted between the traders in short messages. And the question was whether these short messages already reflect the decisions about the stock prices, and whether this is the way the traders prepare their decision making. Now, that was an interesting approach. Indeed. And I mean, it's fascinating, and that's the reason why finance is a fascinating field anyway. I mean, economists tend to complain, it seems, but they describe a whole world. Think of George Soros, who is a scientist, but who's also financially extremely successful. Now, successful traders rely on the models because they need the facts in order to better observe the markets, and they handle them. They can handle them. Now, I have two more questions, and afterwards I would like to ask you to answer the questions from the floor.
It's very nice, and you're asking about who is responsible for looking for the one to blame. Shouldn't this quest be self-reflective as well? And you might ask, why do you differentiate between good and evil in your presentation? Why does it start with looking for the one who is to blame, the guilty one? Wouldn't it have been more useful to differentiate between old and new and think about how to deal better with a new situation compared to our ignorance and how we do it currently in our arrogance? Well, you can always have various approaches, of course, but I'd say, well, as a sociologist, you observe, first of all, what happens in society, and looking for the one to be blamed is very important in finance. Everybody is looking for them, and it's really plausible. So it is justified. And first of all, you need to explain why this is the case. And I wanted to link guilt and debt. It is fascinating, this link. I was fascinated because I saw that in the past it was different, and this guilt feeling has changed. It's a very interesting and fascinating topic to me. But system theorists tend to do that. People of a second order, well yes, as always, not only in the case of guilt. I would like to refer to system theory. This is an insidious question now. You're talking about the finance. Finanzwesen in German, that is the essence of finance. I don't know this term essence in system theory. Maybe you could explain this by using the vocabulary of system theory. No, I'm sorry, I'm not competent for this. This is funny. I would never have used the term Finanzwesen in German, because in English you say finance and finanza in Italian, but I did not translate my book myself, and the translator and the interpreters changed my term finance to Finanzwesen, because they told me it's either Finanzwesen, finance, or Finanzprodukte, financial products. So it might be a financial thing in German, I mean. In Italian, I would have said finanza, so finance, as in English as well, by the way. So we'll call it Finanzwesen in German. This is something lively. Wesen, literally translated into English, meaning the essence or a creature, depending. And it is thus something system, something that corresponds to system theory. Thank you very much. Now, maybe you do have some questions. Some questions from the audience.
Jetzt gehen die Hände hoch.
Now I can see the first people raising their hands. If I got you correctly at the end, the main reproach you can make is that the financial models observe the world as if they were outside. As if they would be outside. So the core of guilt was a deficit in terms of the theory. Maybe from a sociological point of view, can point out how this deficit can be defined. We talk about various regulations of division. That is, you need to separate various banks from one another, and you need to separate various risks. Do you have any ideas about how the reflexivity of thinking in these organizations could be promoted? Well, this is a very important and very, very difficult question, because the model I am proposing is a typical solution for this circularity of the problems. That is kind of a topological idea, because you're always inside. You can't see the things properly. And this has worked for a very long time in finance. Recently, it has been difficult. We discussed this yesterday. Some traditional differences cannot longer be maintained, such as investment and speculation, investment banks, for example, because we have a liquid situation of the financial markets, and it thus cannot be realized very well. So this proposal for a solution is a nice solution, but it is difficult to realize in finance. And then there are examples, the people from finance and the financial markets. They always have the position that they are inside and outside simultaneously, and they use the situation so as to make gains. And this makes the situation more complicated, and the sociologist cannot be outside. This is a big problem, because a sociologist is always inside society, inside the problems he or she is describing. So there are practical reasons that sociologists must have dirty hands, as it were. Thank you very much. Maybe a question to you. You could say philosophers are masters of reflection and economists are masters of calculation. And as I've heard, there are many economists who try to undermine reflection. That is, they want to depict self-reflection in a calculatory manner. You mentioned language philosophy, for example, and there is a certain irrational moment due to the fact that the location from which you speak will play an important role. That is, the expression is particularly important in relation to the statement being made. If I'm in a calculatory system, I'm in a particularly closed system, though. Now, the question is, maybe you're lying to yourself if by a calculation you want to anticipate reflection. So maybe there's the latest model that is to be explored in a calculatory manner, but at the end of the day, you remain in a very closed area. Yes, and this problem is similar to the problem of the other person. That is the other question. I would say something similar. People who work with calculation start including reflexive moments, because calculation always has a soothing effect. You can calculate things. It is something clean, very clear. And you are not inside of the object. You can observe them from outside. And we know that it is difficult to divide things, that calculation needs to include reflective moment as well. And we need to be able to tackle that. Well, we are used to this. This is an old argument, but it is pointed out again and again. We believe that there's a separation between subject and object, but there are some who question this, the division between object and subject. And if we talk about these scenarios, the object is almost forced to find its own role in the objects. And this wouldn't be the case if the object didn't have an object, an impact. And this does not make things arbitrary. You can still observe the object and say that you describe things. It's not an anything goes attitude due to the circulation, but the tools for description must thus be more complex than those that we inherited by tradition. Well, so once again, thank you very much for your presentation and thank you very much for the nice talk. And I would like to hand the floor back to the organizers. The organizers would like to thank you as well. We point out that we've got a break. And we will continue with the reading of Aris Fioretus at 3:30.
seinem Licht?
Schwierig. Ja, super. Wie ist denn die Lautstärke da, Cordula? Ein wenig zu laut kriege ich hier mit. So.